The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Marcia Levick, the director and founder of the Juvenile Law Center, which has successfully worked to rescue children from corrupt judges in Pennsylvania. We'll also have a visit from Israel correspondent Rabbi David Wilfond from Jerusalem and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Passover is finally over, and if you are like me at all, and if you kept some or all of the kosher food rules over the festival of matzah, you're probably pretty pleased to be able to eat regular bread these days. In fact, while I don't actually like pizza very much, there's something wonderful about that first slice of chametz-filled pizza after Passover. In fact, since Pesach ended last week, I've been eating almost nothing but carbohydrates, sort of carb-loading pasta, bread, pastry, and bagels, a near orgy of anti-matzah. It's great. I should also note that, like many Jews, I now have a large stock of unused matzah sitting around my cupboard, so just what does one do with 5 pounds of uneaten matzah after Passover? Well, singer Michelle Citrin has a few outstanding ideas on this subject.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah big and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
Insulate.
Decorate.
9. Exfoliate. 10.
Constipate? Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah doghouse for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye. Or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzah jewelry. Make a picture frame for me. Have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
She really does sound kind of like a Jewish Alanis Morissette, doesn't she? I think my favorite suggestion in that song are using matzah as a frisbee or making it into a coaster to go under your beer. In any case, Pesach is now quite firmly implanted in our religious rearview mirror, and we are into a new phase of the Jewish year, the period of the counting of the Omer. This is an odd and kind of archaic practice in which we recall the ways our ancestors in biblical Israel brought a special grain offering every day between Passover and the holiday of Shavuot, one offering each day for 7 weeks. These serve to mark the 50 days between the Festival of Freedom and the holiday of receiving the Torah at Sinai. The 50th day is Shavuot itself. And this period became a time of additional holiness for our ancestors. During the period of the counting of the Omer, for example, Orthodox and conservative Jews do not perform any weddings. In fact, that's true for the whole state of Israel, with the exception of a few special days interspersed. And each evening of the 7 weeks, we add a small section to our liturgy, our prayers, in which we number the days we have traveled from Passover towards Shavuot. As the book of Proverbs instructs us, we number our days that we might make each day count. In musical terms, this counting of the Omer lends itself to some wonderful musical interpretations. This is the fine choir of the Budapest Rabbinical Seminary and some of the blessing before chanting the counting of the Omer. That was the blessing for the counting of the Omer, the seven-week period between Passover and Shavuot, the holidays of freedom and covenant. If you are actually counting the days, this marks the 12th in the counting of the Omer. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Marcia Levick, an exceptional attorney who discovered that children were being railroaded through the juvenile courts, decided to find out why, and to stop it. It's the remarkable story of the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia, and we'll hear it in a few moments right here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Marcia Levick. She's the co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center, which has been around since 1975, the country's oldest public interest law firm. She currently serves as its deputy director and chief counsel. For more than 30 years, she's been an advocate for children's and women's rights as a nationally recognized leader in juvenile law. She was crucial to the most sort of powerful case that they were involved with, the harsh sentences imposed in Pennsylvania's Luzerne County. And when they began to investigate tough sentences being imposed on children, they discovered a huge corruption case. And we'll talk about that as well. Welcome. Good morning, Marcia.
Good morning. Thank you.
So tell me about the founding of the Juvenile Law Center.
I was one of the co-founders back in 1975. I had actually just graduated from Temple University Law School. And along with three law school classmates, we founded Juvenile Law Center. We were idealists. We were coming of age as law students and college students during the political unrest and civil rights era of the late 60s and early 70s, and we really wanted to be a part of that.
You clearly have become a part of trying to create justice. Maybe you can give us a little bit of an idea of what you all uncovered when you began investigating some very fast hearings in courtrooms in Luzerne County.
Yes, what initially drew our attention to what became the Luzerne County judges scandal was one call from one mother who advised us about what had happened to her daughter, who was a high school sophomore at the time. This is in the spring of 2007. And she described a hearing that lasted about a minute and a half for a very minor criminal charge, harassment, for putting up a parody of her vice principal on MySpace, the social networking site. And she also described how her daughter appeared without counsel and in a matter of about a minute and a half was led off in shackles and handcuffs and placed. And it was a story that resonated for us because we realized very quickly that the judge before whom her daughter had appeared was a judge whom we had challenged similar adjudication of kids without counsel about 7 or 8 years earlier.
And we will explore the ramifications of one of the most fascinating and dramatic cases in the country when we come back with Marcia Levick here on Two Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows by contacting us at the website, twojewishradio.com, or downloading us from the website or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. This week we'll commemorate Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, an annual way to remember those who died in the whirlwind of destruction that engulfed the Jewish people, and during which 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis and their accomplices. Our community Yom HaShoah event here in southern Arizona is at Temple Emmanuel this afternoon at 2 p.m., 225 North Country Club Road. It's free and open to all. And the featured speaker will be scholar and author Alexandra Zapruder, who is with us this morning to give us a preview of her talk this afternoon. Good morning, Alexandra.
Good morning.
The Holocaust has so many different dimensions. You have focused on the diaries written by young people during the Holocaust. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to be focusing on this afternoon?
Sure. I'm going to talk a little bit about young writers' diaries, this body of material that I gathered over about a 10-year period, and how these diaries really shape and frame the way that we can think about daily life during the Holocaust, the way that young people understood it and experienced it. And also, in terms of the relevance for today, how writing can be an act of courage and an act of agency and determination, self-determination at a time when, you know, especially during adolescence, when young people are struggling to find themselves and find out who they are.
So the diaries that you work from, some of them weren't published at all. Some of them are fragmentary. Tell me a little bit about where you found them.
A researcher at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. in the years before the museum opened to the public. And I started off by sort of stumbling on a handful of diaries that had been written and had gone out of print. And that was where the idea sort of came to me, because I read these diaries and they were just extraordinary. They were so immediate and these young voices were so kind of individual. Each one was so different from the others. And so I was sort of puzzled by why these diaries were so obscure and no one really knew about them and everyone knew so much about the Diary of Anne Frank. So that was what got me interested in it. But then as I began researching and reading more and more about children in the Holocaust and writing to archives and scholars and other people around the world, more material started to reach me. So some of it was material that came through archives, diaries that had never been published. Maybe they were translated in English, maybe they weren't. Some of them came to me through survivors. Some of them came through the loved ones of children who had perished during the Holocaust. They really came from all different kinds of sources and in all different kinds of forms.
Well, I've always thought that Anne Frank's extraordinary voice could not possibly have been the only important voice. And I want to thank you for sharing some of those this afternoon at Yom HaShoah. And we'll have you back soon for a full visit. Thank you, Alexander Zapruder.
Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Good morning. As a preview for Yom HaShoah, here is the beautiful, haunting Holocaust song, a setting by composer Max Helfman of the painful poem by Chana Senesh, Ashrei HaGafrur. She was a young Hungarian Jew, a pioneer in Israel, who parachuted into Hungary and died at the hands of the Gestapo, trying to rescue Jews from the Nazis. Blessed is the match consumed in kindling flame, Ashrei HaGafrur, for Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Chana Senesh's poem Ashrei HaGafrur, set to music by Max Helfman, from the CD I Have Taken an Oath to Remember for Yom HaShoah. The commemoration is today at Temple Emmanuel at 2 p.m., 225 North Country Club Road. We welcome our special correspondent from Israel, Rabbi David Wilfon. Good morning, Gingy.
Hi, Sam. Good morning.
Yom HaShoah begins tonight and tomorrow. Some of us in Chutz La'aretz and diaspora celebrating or commemorating it really today. Tell us a little bit about Yom HaShoah in Israel, the Holocaust Remembrance Day.
The center for the Yom HaShoah ceremonies in Israel is Yad Vashem. And I want to tell you a story of something that happened to me at Yad Vashem that has stayed with me ever since. At Yad Vashem, there's a place called the Valley of the Destroyed Communities. It's this maze where you walk through the stones and the names of different towns appear in recreating the map of Europe. And the story goes like this. I went to find my grandfather's shtetl and met with people there who told me about what happened during the war. And then by coincidence, the following week, I was in Israel, and I was at Yad Vashem, and I went to look for the shtetl name on the wall at the Valley of Destroyed Communities, and it wasn't there. So I went to the guard at the beginning, who has the information to tell you where the towns are, and I said, listen, I think there's a mistake. I know about a town where Jews were killed, and it's not here on the wall. And I was kind of shocked. The man kind of Israeli-like kind of barked at me and said, well, how many Jews died there? I said, I think it was about 70. He said, well, it wasn't 100. If it's not 100, we don't put it on the wall. Mm. It took my breath away. It had never occurred to me that they couldn't put all the names on the wall, that there are so many towns that it's overwhelming. There wouldn't be enough stones to write all the names on. So somewhere they had to make a decision, and it's literally thousands of towns, and it's only those with 100 or more. So when I went back there later and looked at it, it made me realize, wow, this is only the tip of the iceberg, what we actually see at Yad Vashem.
So even at Yad Vashem, the most important Holocaust center in the world, they really can't capture not only the enormity, but even the specifics of the Shoah.
There's so many things we don't know. If I could just go on for another like 40 seconds. When I went to the town where my relatives lived and heard about what happened there and met with some elderly Jews, I asked them, what day did this happen? And they said, you know, we don't know the exact day. It was in the month of Tishrei. And suddenly began to understand why we have Yom HaShoah. Because sometimes there's people who died and we don't even know what their Yahrzeit day is. We don't know when to light the candle. And that's why we have Yom HaShoah. So at least there's one day where they are not lost and not forgotten.
Thank you for helping us remember. We'll talk next week, Gingy.
Okay.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with Janos Wilder, the outstanding restaurateur of J-Bar and Janos Restaurant. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
J-Bar's got all kinds of great things going now. Winter Harvest Menu, Recession Busters. Tell us about them.
Well, the Winter Harvest Menu, choice of three main courses, great dishes, all of them geared for this time of year, $12.95. And the Recession Busters, which I'm hoping soon will be the recovery menu.
God willing.
Absolutely. A steak. Right now we're doing a New York strip steak, certified Angus beef with all the J-Bar fixings, chorizo, black beans, salsa, slaw, tortillas, $20.
What a great couple of deals. What's the number for the J-Bar?
615-6100, or you can go online, website www.janos.com.
That's J-A-N-O-S.com. Great meals, great prices at the J-Bar all winter. 615-6100, Janos and the J-Bar.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You were recently in Australia, and we were talking off mic about the Australian Jewish community. Kind of appropriate as we get around Yom HaShoah, the Holocaust Remembrance Day, because although the Australian Jewish community goes back to the first fleet arriving carrying Jewish convicts, we don't like to admit it, but it's true, most of the community came over after World War II, many of them as refugees.
Right. I have the impression that many Australians, Jewish and non-Jewish, are what we would refer to as new Australians, in the sense that, yes, I visited a vineyard where the first vines were planted in 1843, and the same family still owns the soil and still runs the vineyard. And there are cases where people trace their roots in Australia back 150 or even 200 years. But I think the vast majority of Jews, as far as I could tell, have been there for way less than 100 years, and in many cases, since after either the Holocaust or the Hungarian Revolution or whatever, sort of cataclysmic events in Europe that caused people to want to get almost consciously as far away from Europe as they could.
And Australia'd be it. That's...
Well, no, New Zealand.
Oh, New Zealand.
Even
well,
more so.
Right, talking about isolated Jewish communities. You know, I actually had the opportunity to serve as a rabbinic intern in Sydney back in 1994. And I remember my first hospital visits, my first couple of days there, I used every scrap of foreign language I possessed. I mean, I used English, of course, I used Yiddish, I used Hebrew, I used Spanish for those Jews from, you know, who spoke Ladino, I could get by in Spanish. I used a little bit of Italian for Jews who'd come there from Italy. And my non-existent French and German came into play, too. I mean, it was just, that's kind of how it is, a real immigrant community.
So tell me, at this point, based on your knowledge of 15 years ago, but right. Would it be fair to say that every big city in Australia has a Jewish community?
Yes. Melbourne is sort of the mothership of the Jewish community, as it was the original, you know, sort of it's in many ways with Sydney, the biggest city, most important city. Sydney has a wonderful and vibrant Jewish community. In Australia, the Jewish communities in particular say they're Orthodox, but actually most of them live the lives of Reform Jews. There isn't really any conservative Judaism to speak of. There's a Jewish community in the Gold Coast area of Queensland. There's a Jewish community, as you mentioned, in Adelaide, small, but there's a Jewish community in Perth, which is the most isolated Jewish community in the world. It's the most isolated city in the world.
I imagine.
And then some other smaller ones.
Brisbane.
Brisbane, right. Brisbane, a significant
Darwin
city.
Darwin probably has some Jewish doctors.
I am unaware of Darwin having a synagogue, although it may have a crocodile synagogue. I'm not sure. But, you know, always interesting to travel and find these sort of renewing Jewish experiences and sort of seeing communities start in a variety of ways, but they flourish in many cases the same way everywhere in the world.
And they also end in a variety of different ways.
Yes, they do. We'll talk about that next week.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, Tom.
Bye.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. One day, Adam is taking a walk with his sons, Cain and Abel. As they pass the ruined Garden of Eden, Cain asks, "Father, what's that?" "Well, my sons," replies Adam, "that is where your mother ate us out of house and home." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, although new to me, I must admit, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Tazria Metzora in the book of Leviticus, and a wholly unappetizing pair of Torah portions it is indeed. Metzora in particular focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease of the ancient world, but mostly an archaic and pretty disgusting section to us today. It's true that leprosy was an awful thing and needed to be eliminated if at all possible, in particular by using the concept of medical quarantine to isolate it. But exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length in a Sabbath service can scarcely be called a spiritually meaningful experience. The rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem long ago, came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word mitzorah, which means leprosy, was, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew, motzi shem ra, which means slander or evil speech. There's a legal concept in American jurisprudence called fruit of the poisoned tree, which sets out the rules of evidence collected illegally. That is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted and not legally admissible. And so it is with mitzora and all other forms of slander or lashon hara, evil speech. Even when gossip has elements of truth in it, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupt source and not credible or usable. Our moral golden life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, the awful tendency we have to speak ill of others. Commit no slander, and your own life will be clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that are damaging to others, we can find our way clear to living better, holier lives. In the portion this week, we even delineate forms of mitzvah that affect the very houses in which we live, what's called mitzvah bayit. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of property, it may even need to be destroyed, kind of along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And so, as a metaphor, it's quite powerful about the houses in which we live, our organizations, our businesses, our relationships. If we wish to have personal lives and organizations and synagogues and communities in which real holiness can flourish, the dreadful sin of slander has to be eliminated. May we each do our part, now and always, to remove mitzvah, the personal impurities of immoral speech, from our own lives. Our Jewish poetry slam this week comes from the great Israeli poet Rachel and her poem Ve'ulai. Was it only a dream? Was it only a dream? Was it I? Was it I who long ago rose with the dawn to till the fields by the sweat of my brow? Was it I who on long, sultry days of harvesting on a high wagon loaded with sheaves would sing? Was it I who bathed in the innocent blue under a peaceful sky of my Galilee, my own Galilee? Was it all a dream? Was it I? The Israeli poet Rachel's wonderful poem, Ve'ulai, was it only a dream? When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and talk with our guest, Marcia Levick, who has created a center in Philadelphia that saves children from corrupt judges and police. Find out its extraordinary story when we come back on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Budapest, Hungary, more than 1,000 Jews marched through Budapest's Old Ghetto District in response to a series of anti-Semitic incidents in the lead-up to Hungary's national elections. The marchers defied a police recommendation to keep a low profile. They marched to the neighborhood of the Great Dohain Street Synagogue wearing yarmulkes. The police recommended they not do that last week after the windows of Rabbi Shmuel Raskin were stoned in the same district during a Pesach Seder. Over the last week, anti-Semitic graffiti has appeared in various places in Budapest. A Holocaust memorial was defaced in western Hungary, and neo-Nazis held an anti-Semitic rally in the eastern city of Tiszaslar, where a notorious blood libel against the local Jewish community led to pogroms in 1882 and 83 that are quite famous in Hungary. Organized by the Free Folks for Hungary movement and the Association of Hungarian Jewish Religious Communities, the Budapest demonstration was protected by police, and in fact, no violence occurred. Hungarian Jews have expressed concern about anti-Semitic overtones in the national election campaign. The election is set for today, with a possible runoff April 25th. In that election, the ruling Socialist Party is expected to be toppled by the country's main conservative party. A far-right party is also expected to get significant gains. Hungary's Jews traditionally vote center-left. Last week, in what looks like a continuing deterioration of what was once an excellent relationship, Turkey's prime minister called Israel the main threat to Middle East peace. Oy. The remarks by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, made to reporters in Paris, came in the course of a two-day official visit to France. Erdogan also called Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, that noted anti-Semite, his dear friend in an interview with the French paper Le Figaro. The prime minister also said that diplomacy, not sanctions, is the only way to solve the current crisis over Iran's nuclear program, like that's really working. Erdogan also said Turkey would come to the defense of Muslims around the world. We cannot be indifferent to the problems of the Islamic world in Jerusalem, Erdogan reportedly said at a ceremony marking the opening of an Arabic language television and radio company in Turkey. Our task is the integration with the Western world, but we did not turn our back on the East. Arabs and Turks are brothers and we share the same values. Well, usually not. Israel's foreign minister responded to Erdogan's statements, saying it is not interested in confrontation with Turkey. The impression that is being created, however, they said, is that the Turkish prime minister is seeking to integrate with the Muslim world at Israel's expense. In other news, the Muslim Student Union at the University of California, Irvine, UCI, orchestrated the disruption of a February 8th speech by Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren. Leaked emails show Muslim Student Union representatives repeatedly claimed that the disruption, which made national headlines and provoked an academic disciplinary process that is ongoing, was the impetus of students acting individually. 11 students were arrested for disrupting Michael Oren's speech. But the emails were published by the Washington-based Investigative Project on Terrorism. It said that they were leaked anonymously to both university officials and local law enforcement. They demonstrate that the student union, the Arab Student Union, not only helped organize the disruptions, but counseled students to assert that they had acted on their own. In an email to the Muslim Student Union Board, Union President Mohammed Abdul Ghani described the union's game plan for the Oren speech, calling for disruptors. Later, Abdul Ghani, who was himself arrested during the Oren speech, laid out the plan for the event, which he said would involve disrupting it throughout the whole time, if possible. So much for free speech on campus. Abdul Ghani also allegedly cautioned disruptors to be loud and firm, but not lose their composure. Remember, he wrote, this is a planned, calculated response. Of course, but it wasn't planned at all, right? Israel's prime minister will attend President Obama's nuclear security summit next week, but no one-on-one meeting is planned for the two leaders. Netanyahu and Obama met a little more than 2 weeks ago at the White House for discussions that did not resolve a diplomatic impasse over Israel's announcement that it was building 1,600 new housing units in a Jewish neighborhood in eastern Jerusalem. The nuclear summit will deal with issues of non-proliferation and will include the participation of representatives from Pakistan, that noted non-proliferator, and Saudi Arabia. Earlier this week, Obama said the U.S. would adopt a new nuclear policy that will commit our country to avoid using nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states that are in compliance with a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, even if those states attack America with non-conventional arms like biological or chemical weapons. Iran, which will be exempted from the new policy because it is currently in violation of the non-proliferation treaty, is expected to be a major topic of discussion at this conference. Israeli officials indicate they are not concerned that no Obama-Netanyahu meeting is planned. They note that Israel will be one of some 40 countries represented. And President Obama is apparently weighing a new American plan for Middle East peace, keeping up the pressure on Israel. Washington Post columnist David Ignatius cited two unnamed administration sources, I love those guys, who said Obama is seriously considering putting forth a proposal to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Good luck. According to one of the officials, the plan will be linked to the issue of Iran, whose suspected nuclear weapons program is the top strategic priority of Israel's leaders and a top legislative agenda for American pro-Israel community. Incrementalism hasn't worked, the officials quoted as saying. As a global power with global responsibilities, we have to do something. The plan, he said, would take on the absolute requirements of Israeli security and the requirements of Palestinian sovereignty in a way that makes sense. Boy, that will be an accomplishment. Anyway, this proposal could be launched by the fall. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Marcia Levick. She's the co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center in the Philadelphia area, the country's oldest public interest law firm for children. I think we omitted that at the beginning of the show. Currently serves as a deputy director and chief counsel for over 30 years, actually more like 35 years. She's been an advocate for children's and women's rights, is a nationally recognized leader in juvenile law. And we began to speak about the Luzerne County judges scandal, in which the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia began to explore very harsh sentences imposed for shockingly trivial crimes on very young, offenders. You started us on that path talking about how somebody posted sort of a critical comment on MySpace about a vice principal and was sentenced like immediately in a minute and a half or something. Tell me what you uncovered once you began to investigate.
We began to investigate whether or not her case was just one of many in which children were appearing before this judge in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, without lawyers and were being really pushed through very summary proceedings, very quick proceedings, and in many cases being placed away from their homes in juvenile facilities. We collected data over the course of approximately the next 8 or 10 months. We had some assistance from a research arm of our one of the universities here in Pennsylvania that collects data for every county in Pennsylvania on the workings of their juvenile court and orders that are issued in other matters. We spoke with individuals in Luzerne County. We visited the courthouse and spent some time in the waiting room actually talking to parents and kids coming out of the courtroom. And what we ultimately were able to piece together was a very pervasive pattern and practice by this one judge sitting in juvenile court over a period of years. Initially, we were looking at a period between 2005 and 2008 in which the judge routinely violated children's constitutional right to counsel, a right that the Supreme Court of the United States had established back in 1967.
It's rather it's a horrible story, really. I mean, it's a great story in that they were brought to justice, but a lot of these kids were actually shackled, sent away to jail for, you know, pushing a classmate or, you know, really trivial stuff.
Yes, that's correct. I think one of the many aspects of the case that really troubled us, in addition to any time someone's constitutional rights are violated, I think we as lawyers need to sit up and take notice. But we've been doing and we've been working in the juvenile justice field, as you indicated, for over 3 decades. And to be placing children, pulling kids out of their communities, away from their homes and families, putting them into, in many instances, some fairly secure, locked juvenile facilities for very, very minor misconduct is really not what our juvenile justice system should be about.
The Jewish concept, tzedek, tzedek tirdof, you should pursue justice, you know, it predates the American system by a long way. But it is at the heart of sort of how Jews have thought about the law. The two judges involved, they're both up for sentencing, aren't they? Or are they still on trial?
Well, they actually haven't gone to trial yet. Another interesting twist in the story is that the two judges initially actually pled guilty to minor charges of tax evasion and wire fraud for receiving, it turned out, about $2.5 million in kickbacks from the owner and developer of two of the facilities to which this judge was committing kids. And it became very clear to us in terms of connecting the dots that the routine denial of counsel, the allowance of these kids to go forward without counsel, really allowed these judges to perpetuate this scheme. You get lawyers out of the courtroom, you remove obstacles, in the best of cases, to improper and unjust decisions, and they were able to do that. They initially pled guilty, and over a period of several months, ultimately the federal criminal court judge, they've been charged by the U.S. attorney here in Pennsylvania, rejected their pleas. They had pled to a sentence of 7 years, and in rejecting their pleas, the judges withdrew their pleas, and the U.S. attorney very quickly actually turned around and refiled a new indictment against them, which is now a 48-count indictment. Mm. So they are they will have a trial date at some point in the criminal court here, federal criminal court, but we don't have a date for that yet.
It's really an extraordinary, it's a terrible story. In essence, they accepted bribes to send kids to private jails.
That's what we believe. That's correct.
And the state ends up, of course, paying for those kids being incarcerated. So it's
the state and the county, yes. This is public dollars that were paid for that placement.
And then some of it gets kicked back to these guys.
A very significant amount. The amount at issue here,
$2.5 million.
Right. We've never really seen anything, I'm quite sure, in our legal system. Where this amount of money changed hands, and on the backs of kids.
It's just extraordinary that you guys uncovered it, and horrific that it happened at all. The Forward Jewish newspaper, which I think is the best Jewish newspaper in the country, one of the best in the world, named you one of the Forward 50 most important Jews in America. How's that feel?
It came as a complete surprise, I have to say. But it also, it's a great honor, obviously. I think, as you said, the pursuit of justice is at the heart, I think, of certainly the tenets of the Jewish religion. And to be someone who has, frankly, had the privilege of dedicating my professional life to doing that is something that is very precious to me.
Besides this particular case, what do you feel are the most important cases you've dealt with?
We have been involved in many other cases in which we have really fought for justice for kids in a very sort of simplistic way, but we have brought lawsuits on behalf of other children who have been placed in facilities where they were abused. We have challenged particular state statutes which we felt violated children's rights to due process, may have denied them access to education. We have been involved in an array of lawsuits and other kinds of policy endeavors over the course of the history of Juvenile Law Center, all of which has been about really promoting fairness for children in the juvenile justice and child welfare system, and really promoting their access to justice.
Have Jewish ideals motivated you at all, or is it more 60s idealism?
I think that I have grown up in a progressive family, a progressive Jewish family. I'm also a product of Quaker education, and I think that the combination of kind of time and circumstance and background all have really come together to motivate me to do the kind of work that I do.
Now, Quaker and Jewish combination can only happen in Pennsylvania, can't it?
That's probably true. yes, we are a Quaker state.
and it's not just about oil either. It's
that's correct, yes.
Where does your funding come from? Because there can't be a lot of money in pursuing justice for juveniles who have been wronged by, in fact, the state.
It's not easy to raise money. We raise money primarily from foundations, national and local foundations around the country. And we certainly also do raise a certain amount of our budget every year from individual donors. We have a budget of just about $2 million. We pretty much raise it anew every year, but we have been fortunate to be able to keep going. We are in particularly stressed economic times, of course, now. Everyone is personally, it's a difficult time for fundraising, but it comes from individuals and foundations for the most part.
Where can people go to find out more about the Juvenile Law Center?
I would encourage folks to look at our website, which is jlc.org. It is not only lots of information about the history of the organization, but a tremendous amount of information about all of the work that Juvenile Law Center has been involved in, that we are currently involved in, and up-to-the-minute information, actually, about what is going on with the Luzerne County judges scandal. So again, that's jlc.org.
jlc.org is a website for the Juvenile Law Center. And again, you know, this is really a case, although, you know, I'm sort of tempted to say, you know, it's terrible to think about it, but really it's a fascinating story and a real illustration of the fact that corruption and injustice exist in America, and they need to be rooted out by organizations like the JLC and by people like Marcia Levick. I want to thank Marcia for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert Cohen.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Next week, our guest will be the outstanding young violinist, perhaps the best in the world today, Vadim Gluzman. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from the Jews of Uganda, the Abu Yudaya, singing Ali Omuyeka, My Only One. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Kane panke kubanze ni no murugi wange choko murugi wange moyo yedukita wange nzene wembanga ndwade moyo yedukita wange nebembanga njavua de moyo yemugaga wange moyo yemurugi wange moyo yemugaga wange nsera likire nyoko banze ni no murugi wange nsera Kanzane wane kuwanze ni no murugi wange, nde kanzane
choka mwe gombanze ni namuruji wange choka kane wan wanze ni namuruji wange oyo namuruji wange oyo ye dokita wange oyo ye mugago wange oyo ye muruji wange ni namugago wange ayo ye ka Siri namulala wange yomuruji wange
Namukazi wange Nora yomuyeka Siri namulala wabulo yomuruji wange
Kyoka kane wane kubanze ni nomuruji wange Mundegenze nepa kubanze no nomugazi wange
Namukazi wange Nora yomuyeka Siri namulala wabulo yomuruji wange
Namugazi wange nze ayomuyeka nze siri namulala wabulo yomwe nalonda yeka
Namugazi wange ayomuyeka nze siri namulala wabulo yomugazi wange
Muruji wange
ayomuyeka
Omugaga wange
ayomuyeka
Omuruji wange
ayomuyeka
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.